The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Last session we talked about, we started talking about the kinds of agenda that urban anthropology has now, since the last three decades. And we had broken that up into the discussions of urban anthropology in the 1960s, the 1970s. And we talked a lot about peasants in cities, the concern of urban anthropology for the life of peasants in cities. We talked a little bit about how some of these things can be used in Christian ministry. Now I want to go on to the second area of, or the second agenda issue that has characterized urban anthropology in the 1960s and 70s. First one was peasants in cities. The second one we can call problem-centered studies. This formed a sort of a second area of research in the earliest stages of urban anthropology as a discipline. And under a topic like this, there were several in particular that gathered a lot of attention. I'm going to mention three of them. There is a book by two authors, Eames, E-A-M-E-S, and Good, G-O-O-D-E. The book's called Anthropology of the City. And this book, this dated from the late 70s, but they sort of summarized this early agenda. And I'm using their outline. The most prominent issue in the 1960s and 70s was the issue of poverty. You remember Robert Redfield had talked about this village in Mexico. They had been discussing the whole progress from a village to urban life. And the man who had opposed him was a fellow by the name of Oscar Lewis. Oscar Lewis was the central figure in the discussions on the issue of poverty in the 1960s and 70s. What gave him a very central place in the studies was his theory of what came to be called the culture of poverty. Lewis was very well known. He wrote a series of very famous series of biographical anthropology books. This was a unique specialization where Lewis would go into and live with just one family for a year and a half. I pity the family, but anyway. And then he would just poke into everything that was going on in the life of the family. He wrote several classic books this way. Probably the most well-known was a book called The Family of Sanchez. And in fact, that was made into a Hollywood movie, which was considerably less significant than the book. But in those kinds of books, Oscar Lewis was driven to ask questions like, why are people poor? And further, why do some poor people remain isolated in the ghettos? Why do poor people stay poor? As he studied this kind of chronic poverty, he found himself asking, can chronic poverty become an actual culture? Can chronic poverty produce its own distinct way of life, its own worldview, its own social structure? And he said, yes, it can. And many of his books then asked the question, what are the characteristics of a so-called culture of poverty? Now, this topic has been, since Oscar Lewis introduced it, this has become a violent discussion. Uh, the, uh, I think in some of the bibliography I've given you, you can see some of the responses to this argument. Frankly, when I listen to some of the debates going on now in politics, it's like listening to these debates all updated. People talk about, why are people so poor? And why can't folks get off welfare? Why can't folks get off the dole? And then somebody responds with a language that sounds vaguely reminiscent of the culture of poverty. Some people applauded it because it made us pay attention to the issue of poverty. Other people said all we're doing in the end then is just blaming the victim once more. The issue is still up for grabs, but this was one of the major centers of discussion in the 1960s and 70s. Now, I think the implications of this as I see it anyway, of this kind of study for Christian ministry and for the mission of the church is extensive. As usual, Christians sort of tag along. The world sort of says, let's put this on the agenda, and then usually about 10 to 20 years later, Christians come along and say, aha, let's study the poor. And that's about what has happened with this. But thankfully, a great deal of Christian research has focused on this topic in the last two decades. If you've noticed anything at all about Christian literature, there's an awful lot of people talking about the poor. And they weren't talking about them 20 years ago. What are our Christian social responsibilities towards the poor? How should the church respond to human poverty? What does the Bible say about poverty? Is poverty systemic? Biblically speaking, is there a culture of poverty? What about the distribution of wealth? What does Paul mean in Corinthians when he says that there should be distribution so that all receive equally? What is that? What are the implications of that for Christian ministry? How do we relate in a biblical way evangelism and social responsibility? In the 1980s, 1982, 1983, 1984, somewhere in there, there was the Lausanne Committee on World Evangelization sponsored a major consultation. It was held in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and it was a consultation on the relationship of evangelism and social responsibility. It's sometimes called the Kresser Conference. It was a major gathering. There were about 50 to 60 people from around the world. Two people prepared the report that came out of the consultation. One was David Wells from Gordon Conwell. The other one was David Bosch from the University of South Africa. The report is just a reflection of the discussions of the conference. There was no manifesto or anything that anybody signed. We just said all we're going to do is publish a report telling people this is what we talked about. Anyway, there was a book published that came out of that. Most of the papers were edited. The book is edited by Bruce Nichols, and it's called In Word and Deed, published by Erdmans. That is probably the most up-to-date example of where evangelical consensus has reached on this issue. The point of the discussion was, look, we all agree evangelism is important. We all agree social responsibility is important. The question is how to put the two together. So the conference focused on the relationship of evangelism to social responsibility. But it was a very important conference in my judgment, and it's closely tied in with the fact that now evangelicals are spending a lot of time dealing with this issue of poverty and wealth and what to do about it in the world. If poverty creates its own culture, for example, if poverty creates its own culture, is it enough for the church merely to respond to emergency needs, to respond to individual needs? Isn't the church obligated by the very character of poverty as a culture to respond to it on that larger cultural level? Further, just to give you, I'm just listing what we have to do. Further, if the poor consist of this vast underclass, not lower class, but underclass, what are our obligations for church planting among the poor? Apart altogether from what the Bible says about poverty, what about church planting? Viv Grigg, a missionary from New Zealand, estimates that the poor population of the world double in size every 10 years. And at the present time, I think it's a little bit over 25% of the world's population now live far under the poverty, the official poverty line. And yet, though the vast majority of people in the world are poor, it is the largest minority group in the world. Why is it that the church is almost totally absent among the poor? Why is it, by contrast, that the church around the world is largely middle class or upper class? Yes.
The official poverty line, how do they, how do they assess something like that?
Well, in this case, they're using, in the case I'm citing, they're using American definitions of what the poverty line is.
I know some of the definitions I see. So if you don't have indoor plumbing, you don't have electricity, then you're poor.
Yeah.
From Africa, it's not really satisfactory.
Yes, right. Particularly when in some places no one has indoor plumbing. I think there are other statistics. I don't have them now to give you, but the World Bank has also other definitions of poverty that I think are probably much closer to expressing a global kind of dimension. And their statistics are about as gloomy as the ones I'm giving to you now. In any case, no matter how you look at it, what we're seeing is a massive multiplication of the poor. And however many there are, what people like Viv Grigg and others are saying is, shouldn't there be at least an equivalent percentage of churches being planted among the poor? But as a matter of fact, we are seeing in massive cities huge slums, shanty towns, but you are not finding churches planted there. Why is that so? Why are there globally so few churches among the poor? Why are there so few churches in the slums, in the shanty towns? How do we plant churches among the poor? How do we do it with integrity? And that seems to me to be a crucial issue in missions today.
I can see one possible problem with that because I guess one of the reasons is that we don't have the leadership that's willing to go in there and do the ministry.
Yeah.
But if you pick up the people out of that, its own culture, poverty, culture,
yeah.
Then the problem I can anticipate is that, the seminary study is high-level study, I guess.
Yeah.
And people are just not equipped to swallow it.
Yeah.
So how do we draw the line where, well, you're qualified, well, you're too ignorant to...
Right. Well, I think part of the answer is going to be, James, that in many cases, the planning of the churches will be done by people who have, hopefully, who've never been to theological seminary. The leadership for the church planting ministry will come from those areas themselves, and they'll come from leaders, most of whom have never been to college and have never been to had any kind of Bible or theological training. But even there, that's not happening now. Viv Grigg has written a number of essays in our little journal, Urban Mission, on this. And over again, he brings you such an overwhelming number of statistics, there's just no way to escape it. But it does seem to me that, at least in Latin America, that's what's happened. The church planting that is going on is not being done by missionaries. Nor is it being done by people with a great deal of education. The churches are growing naturally, and they're growing within the slums themselves, which seems to me to be the best way to see it happen. But it's these are crucial issues. I mean, tied in with this one, I don't know if any of you have read this book. There's a brother with the Mennonites. He was a missionary in East Africa, or in Ethiopia for many years with the Mennonite Brethren Church of Canada. His name is Jonathan Bonk, B-O-N-K. And he's now a professor at Winnipeg Theological Seminary in Canada. And he's just published a book published by Orbis Books, the Roman Catholic Press, called Missions and Money. I do not recommend you read this book when you're feeling a little low or depressed. There's every likelihood you'll go out and eat rat poison. It is not the kind of book that that lifts you up, but it is the kind of book that is absolutely essential, because what he does is this is based on his doctoral studies at the University of Aberdeen. He takes a look at missions in the 19th and 20th centuries, and he talks about the impact on the mission field of missionary affluence. He talks about missionary wealth, the contrast that it has made with with the churches on the field, the antagonism it has often helped to create, suspicion, all these things. And the book is very powerfully documented. Almost all the book just deals with all these examples. And in the last chapter, he says, "Now, what do we do about this other than suicide?" And he offers some positive suggestions. So I think probably a lot more could be said. But the book is so careful in its diagnosis; it's almost overwhelming. Very hard to refute the kinds of things he's laying out in front of us. And he said, "Now, look, this is." Here's the identification. When the world has thought about missions and missionaries, until recently, the world has identified, by and large, the missionary force with the Western white world. And that means, in many cases, it's identified then the missions cause with the colonialists, or with those who have come in to sort of take away. It means also it's identified the cause of Christianity with probably the wealthiest segment of the world's population. What effect has this had on the cause of Christ? How has this impacted the Christian task today? And the book's a very powerful one, but boy, it's raising these kinds of issues. And I think that it's helpful. Thankfully, in circles like ours, we're beginning to ask these questions now, because they started asking them 20, 30 years ago in the courses in urban anthropology. Let me give you another. These are problem-centered issues that were raised. Here's another one. In the United States especially, early interest of urban anthropology focused on minority group research. One of the classic books in urban anthropology Elliot Lepo. And the book is called Tally's Corner. The book came out in 1967. It's not a very large book, but it's still a classic. And there's a lot of help in terms of understanding the street culture of the American black. But books like that began to show up, in which people would do things like this author did. You examine one specialized subculture, in this case, the life of the black male in the street culture of a large American city. Other books like this focused on Puerto Ricans, Italians, issues of ethnicity. What was ethnicity? Why does ethnicity continue to survive? Here's Philadelphia, a multi-ethnic city with all kinds of different cultures. Why is it that all those different cultures continue to be there? Why don't they all sort of jumble together into one melting pot? What happens? What do you think about this thing called the melting pot theory? Is it accurate? What's wrong with it? How do ethnics relate to one another in the city? What's the connection between Koreans and blacks in a city like Philadelphia? How do they come together? One of the, as some of us have been studying in another class, one of the popular suggestions for this has been called the melting pot theory, and the idea that America is a great melting pot, and that within this melting pot now, as people come from different parts of the world, they come from China, Argentina, Uganda, that they'll all sort of melt together, and what will come out will be something new and better than ever before, or something that will look like white people. That's the melting pot kind of idea. Now people are beginning, at this time, people are beginning to criticize this theory. A book is written by two authors, Nathan Glazer and Daniel Monahan, who is now the senator from New York City, New York State. The book is called Beyond the Melting Pot. And now they begin to examine, these two authors look at New York City, and they study four or five separate subcultures in New York City that are living together, asking themselves, why do they still live together and they're still and yet still maintain their distinctness as a culture? What's going on here? These are the kinds of questions people are asking. How do you explain the process of acculturation in a city? Is it simply a matter of assimilation, or is it something more? What goes on? Now, these kinds of questions, again, are the kinds of questions that I think the Christian church needs to ask and to explore for the sake of the gospel. At this time, the movement within the Christian church that did more than any other movement to study these issues was the church growth movement. The church growth movement began about the mid-1960s, associated with the name of Donald McGavran. McGavran was a missionary in India for almost all of his life. Actually began his teaching career, I think, at the age of 65. He was invited to bring his school of church growth down to Fuller Theological Seminary. So he joined the staff of Fuller, and out of that came the church growth school and virtually the whole movement. Now, it was at the center of the church growth school at that time, at the center of a lot of McGavran's thinking, his writing, were all these issues. What is ethnicity? What difference does it make for church planning if you use different languages? What about social class differences? And at the heart of all these discussions came McGavran's idea of the homogeneous unit. At least that's what he called it then. And the idea behind the homogeneous unit was everybody likes to become a Christian without crossing racial, linguistic, ethnic, or social lines. That, in essence, was the homogeneous unit principle. No one likes to become a Christian by being forced to cross those lines. So what McGavran, in this discussion, was assuming was the stability of things like ethnicity and social class, even in the city. Just to give you a sample of this, McGavran was one of the first people that I have ever read in recent times that ever wrote about the city. In 1970, McGavran published a book called Understanding Church Growth. I think copies in the bookstore, right, Jim? The book has gone through two editions. In the first edition, which appeared in 1970, McGavran had a whole chapter on church growth in the city. That was, to my knowledge, virtually the first time that anybody in this whole during this whole time had written something about church planting in the city. And even to this, even then, as I read that chapter again, he has like I think 8 keys to church growth, and still very practical. They need a lot of modification, maybe a change here or there, but still very, very useful keys. The chapter remained in the second edition, which came out in 1980. The last edition has been rewritten by Peter Wagner, and he has dropped entirely the chapter on the city, which I think is despicable. Did you hear me, Peter? I just can't understand why. Maybe it was the editor, the publishers, I don't know. But if anything, urban stuff has become much more prominent since he first wrote that book, and now that whole chapter has been totally scrubbed. But I think it's remarkable that a guy like that, a person like that, could have seen so many things as he did 20 years ago. McGavran did something that I think, no matter what you think about McGavran forced the church to make very radical changes that I think have been on the whole, very, very beneficial. For example, McGavran forced the church to ask strategy questions. And to ask strategy questions based on issues like ethnicity and social structure. Can a church be planted by targeting special people groups? Is that all right? Is that biblical? Does it work? How can the particularity of an ethnic group, the uniqueness of an ethnic group, be used to produce new and growing churches? It was Don McGavran that placed those issues on the agenda of the Christian church. Nobody else. McGavran forced us to look again at what does all this mean for church growth. McGavran insisted over and over again in his writings through the 60s that it was precisely through these kinds of people groups, ethnic, social, linguistic, whatever you want to call them, but through these people groups that the church had grown in the past. One of his most interesting books still, I think, is the very first book that he wrote, he wrote several before, but the book was called The Bridges of God. It's not a big book, but one of the most interesting... One of the most interesting parts of it was his argument throughout the book that by and large, as you study the history of the church, that most of the time, the great majority of church growth has taken place in movements or groups. And he goes all through church history, both in the West and all over the world, to point that out. And I think it's just, the argument's irrefutable. That's just the way the church has grown. You think of how, for example, Europe, you can remember from church history, often, you know, one of those queens or somebody, a king up in Scandinavia decides to get baptized. Everybody gets baptized. England was animistic, worshipped druids. Until there was druid worship in England. And then along came, Arthur the Great? I can't remember the name. Bang, everybody decided to become Christians. And of course, when you first looked at that, you thought, well, this isn't really conversion, is it? Well, those British have been around a long time worshiping Jesus, haven't they? And McGavran said, we've got to look at these movements again. We've got to get rid of our individualistic blinders and ask ourselves, what happened when these groups came to Christ? Is there anything we can learn from here about strategy for church planting? McGavran was grabbing hold of all these ideas of ethnicity and applying them in the city long before anybody else was. And he argued that our American individualism, by and large, has obscured, it's succeeded in obscuring this reality from us. So McGavran promoted church growth research. Research into church growth around the world. Yeah, there was the amount of literature that has come from this research is amazing. I can remember when I was a student here in the 1950s, mid-50s, and we took a course from Dr. Clowney in missions, and about the only course they offered here. And you'd go up into the library to look for books on missions. This was by the mid-1950s, we had about one half of a shelf. That was all that was available on missions. Now, I literally cannot keep up with the books that pour out on missions. Histories, everything else. And a large part of that, I think, came from the stimulus and the encouragement of McGavran. He got his students to study. He said, don't give me all of this generalization about God is blessing Uganda. What do you mean God is blessing Uganda? Is the church growing in Uganda? Is your church growing as fast as that church in Uganda? Why is your church not growing as fast as that church? Tell me why. Show me the statistics. Take a close look. And McGavran said, let's push the fog away and take a hard look at what actually is going on. So it was McGavran's hand that moved the church into careful studies of church growth literally around the world, a study which all of us have continued to benefit from. But the and he was looking in much of this, as you read these case studies over and over again, here are the people groups. One of the earliest published studies was a book by David Liao on Taiwan. And it was published, I think, by Moody Press, and it dealt with the Hakka people in Taiwan. And the Hakka people are, there are a large number of people groups in Taiwan. And when anybody ever dealt with the Hakka, they'd always note, well, there's hardly any Christians among these people. Well, why aren't there any Christians, McGavran asked. Most people's answer would be, well, because the Hakkas are resistant to the gospel. What do you mean resistant to the gospel? Have they had a chance to hear the gospel? Tell me about their history. So David Liao started digging into the history. And he found out that these people aren't resistant at all. They're neglected. They've even heard the gospel. He pointed out to the infinitesimally small number of Christians who knew the Hakka language. There were, I think, up until the 1960s, only one or two missionaries who ever bothered to learn the language. And so he said, these people aren't resistant to the gospel, they're neglected. And that was exactly the kind of study that McGavran was encouraging all over the place. McGavran's focus in all of this was on the so-called third world. That was where he came from. So the studies that came in the early 1960s into the 70s was largely oriented to the situation overseas. I think still one of the best books on church growth is on Korea. And it's by a former missionary in Korea by the name of Roy Shearer. The book is called Wildfire, Church Growth in Korea. It's still one of the most carefully done studies. And what he did was he concentrated on the Presbyterian Church, and he literally microfilmed all of the minutes of presbyteries and then analyzed the growth in Korea presbytery by presbytery. One of the most beautiful examples of how to do research. Sadly, when he got past 1945, I think the book fell apart. Anyway, he and I had one or more discussions on that part of the book. In any case, it was a beautiful piece of work. What happened in the 1980s and the 70s was that now suddenly as people began to come to Dr. McGavran's classes, and they began to think, several of them graduated, thinking, can't we use this for studies in the United States and in Europe? And for the first time, some people began to work at applying some of McGavran's ideas to church growth in the United States. A gentleman by the name of Wynn Arn, A-R-N, led in some of this. He lectured here at Westminster taught a course here about 4 years ago, I think. And Peter Wagner, Dr. McGavran's successor, began to concentrate his studies on church growth in the United States. So he took a lot of McGavran's general ideas, but now began to wrestle with how to use them for church growth and church planting in the United States. But again, what's exciting about all this is it is one of the few places where at least evangelicals have managed to keep up with secular studies in the area of ethnicity and dealing with subcultures. Let me mention the third one, third study area. Deviant groups. Yes, Mr. Howard.
I was explaining more about Peter Weber and
well, how okay.
Did he apply Nicaragua's ideas to America?
Okay, thank you. Some others of you chip in too here, please. But Wagner was had worked as a missionary in Bolivia for many years. He had become convinced of Dr. McGavern's approach. And so he was invited to teach with McGavern at Fuller Seminary. He's been there now for, 15 years or so, maybe longer. But as he began his first work, his first books were like Dr. McGavern's, very largely on all the examples he gave were drawn from largely from Latin America, Africa, Asia. Then he began to shift his emphasis and began to appear in his books more and more materials on church growth in the United States especially. Until really that is virtually the dominant focus of his writing maybe during the last 10 years. Wouldn't you say that, Woody? He has also been very active at Fuller Seminary in training doctoral candidates in this area. Now, how has he applied it? Well, for example, he has argued the most influential book in this area was a book called Our Kind of People. Wagner wrote this book, and it is a summary of his doctoral dissertation written at the University of Southern California. It is his effort theologically to defend the homogeneous unit principle. So if you want any book that gives you a good, the best theological defense of the homogeneous unit, it's Wagner's book. Anyway, out of the book, he argued that really the whole book focuses on what is the nature of ethnicity, what is the impact of ethnicity on a people mind? And then he argued that you can find this same kind of character throughout the New Testament. He deals with the differences between Jews and Gentiles and argues that really these are differences that indicate separate, distinct people groups. So Wagner's thesis then was that this principle ought to apply anywhere at all. And then what he has done is to use it in seeing American cities the same way. So, for example, in an American city, you're going to see all kinds of ethnic groups within the city. You will notice, says Wagner, these ethnic groups do not easily mix in the same churches. For example, we often talk about Hispanics. But that term is too large a category. If you go to Miami, Florida, you'll notice that Cubans and Mexicans do not get along together in the same church. You cannot easily create a church made out of Puerto Ricans and people from Central America. They don't get along. Well, why don't they get along? They all speak one language. Because they are distinct people groups. So, says Wagner, even in the United States, you will see this same characteristic showing up over and over again. Also, there will be differences in American cities between social classes. Wagner argues that the social dimension should take much more, we should pay more attention to that in American cities. Because the social distinctions between the classes are often as significant, if not more significant, than our ethnicity. It's very hard to find churches where rich and poor are together. Very hard to find churches where there is multi-social classes within the fellowship. And that, says Wagner, is an example of the homogeneous unit at work in American cities. So what's the answer? Well, like McGavran, we plant churches. We focus on the planting of churches that will target specific groups of people. So we need all kinds of churches. Wagner, McGavran, many of us, myself included, will emphasize very strongly the importance of planting new churches. Why? Because new churches grow Christians faster than old ones. Because new churches are anxious to find people for Christ. And also because new churches usually have, the Christians in those churches still have non-Christian friends they can try to reach out to. The older a Christian you become, the less non-Christian friends you have. How can you go evangelize non-Christians when you don't know any? All these things Wagner applies to American cities. But I think basically that's how he's done it. Have I missed anything? What do you know? Didn't you study under Pete at Fuller?
No. I've read a lot of his stuff, though.
Yeah. You think I'm being fair?
Yeah, I think you're being fair, but I might add there is a lot of controversy over the homogeneous unit principle, especially just on textual grounds, just biblical grounds. In Christ there is equality, Galatians 3:28. I still have a real hard time with it. If you look at it sociologically, you can say, yes, they're right. It's easier to plant churches and to keep churches ethnically separated.
Yeah.
But if we're all one in Christ and we can sit together in this class with no problem, why can't other churches do the same? So there's something in my heart that just militates against that and says we must come up with some multicultural models. And there are some.
Yes, yeah.
And, you know, in the end of time, there's people from every tribe, tongue, people, and nation gathered together around the throne of God in praise. Can't the church be a precursor of that now?
Yeah.
There's a lot of controversy like that that goes back and forth and back and forth.
It's interesting to me that I may have missed this, but you will not find, if you read through Wagner's current books, and he writes books like Dr. Adams, you know, a book, he writes books faster than I can read. You will not find Wagner using terms now like homogeneous unit principle. Dr. McGavran went to be with the Lord last year. He was 92 years of age when he died. He also, in his later writing, seemed to have dropped this term. As Woody mentions, it was criticized. Some of us have been some of the people who have criticized it. But he did prefer, when he talked about urban things, he would talk about urban mosaics, and he would use that language. And he would talk about the different kinds of pieces that there are in cities, and how together they form sort of a picture, an urban picture, a mosaic of what the city should be under God. I think basically he meant the same kind of thing, but he was trying to avoid this language, which was, as Woody has said, was very, very controversial and still remains an object of very heated discussion. I think, you know, however you look at the homogeneous unit principle or whatever we're talking about, I think it's a remarkable thing that right at this moment, when all these anthropologists are talking about subgroups and ethnicity, the Lord raises up someone like McGavran and a school like the Church Growth School that suddenly makes these topics the very center of church strategy. And I think we have to acknowledge that. That is a genuine gift from the Lord. I think in our circles, in, say, our Reformed circles, I generally feel that McGavran tends to be slighted, that he's put aside. He can very often be criticized. I've heard him criticized in classes here in the seminary by students. Will say, "Oh, he's Arminian," which is a gem. You know, that's about the worst curse anybody can ever give anybody. Or you know, he's not really thinking through the sovereign grace of God. What does he mean when he says, for example, in one of his earlier books, that the basic obstacles to becoming a Christian are not theological, but sociological. Obviously, this sounds heretical. The more I think about it, it makes a lot of sense, but anyway. There have been a lot of frustrations over his expressions, over his the way he puts things. many of these kinds of things. And yet, at the same time, admitting all those things, you are reading the words of a man whom, in the judgment of many, many people, will probably emerge in history as one of the five most significant writers in missiology in the 20th century. I agree with that. It's why, so his writing is very significant, if not for anything else, just the marvelous way the Lord put him right at this particular time and place and helped us to begin to wrestle with tools that we can use in evangelizing cities and thinking about ethnicity. That's a remarkable gift. Yes, James.
I haven't read anything about Gavin's book. I'm not sure if it's relevant anyway, but I just want to hear that. But I lived in Texas for about a year and a half in Texarkana. It's kind of a little town.
Uh-huh.
And I visited a lot of different churches, like Pentecostal and Presbyterian, and mm-hmm. you know, Southern Baptist, all that. And there's a tension between black and white. And I would visit black churches and, you know, white churches. And,
yes.
There were a few churches that had mixed, you know, but it was dominant anyway on either side. So I kind of struggled with that issue. You know, we keep talking about, you know, everybody in Christ, and, you know, we seem to ignore that. So I even thought about dreaming, like, you know, I'm going to adopt a white kid and a black kid and my own Oriental kid, and I'm going to raise all these different ethnic people,
uh-huh.
and hopefully they'll minister to the world later on, you know, with this attitude, you know. But then I realized that that's probably not the most healthiest education for them. I don't think this is relevant, but...
Sounds like a good TV sitcom.
I didn't hear that one.
Sounds like a good TV sitcom.
Well, I think that there's... I know of several families, several white families, here in the United States, that have when they did adopt, specifically adopted black children. And I think a couple that I know as Christians, out of conviction, similar kinds of convictions, that they wanted their family to be places where they could demonstrate the unity of Christ.
In fact, in South Africa, it's increasingly, you know, I know one lady who was a customer at the bookstore that I used to run there, I think he had adopted a black child, and there it was a really courageous thing to do. There were some people who were really committed to doing that. Yeah.
It's I think if I think sort of your instinct, James, in terms of thinking, well, maybe this isn't the best thing to do, in a sense. If I'm reading you right, those are the kinds of instincts maybe that Dr. McGavin would respond with. simply because, I think because ethnicity is such an important part of us, it's not just the coat that we can take on or off, it's us. And it's also us in terms of when we worship before the Lord. So how can we make use of that? And I think the question is the one that I'm, you know, that I think Woody and others are raising. How can you recognize your specialness and this group's uniqueness, and yet at the same time affirm that we belong in one body? So how do you, it's sort of like balancing. How do you balance the Catholicity of the Church, the universality of the body of Christ, and at the same time rejoice within that circle in your uniqueness? As a black, your uniqueness as a Korean, your uniqueness as Chinese and as white. And I think that's the struggle. I was a member of the first in the, oh boy, back in the, I think, was it 78, 79? I was a member of the Lausanne Committee dealing with theology issues. And the very first meeting that we ever sponsored as a consultation was on the homogeneous unit principle. It was held in Pasadena, California, and I can still remember that one. I was dumb enough to accept the invitation to respond to Dr. McGavin, and it was a very interesting time. There were 10 papers. There were 5 papers written by faculty members at Fuller, and then 5 people asked to respond to the papers. I responded to Dr. McGavern. Let's see, Glasser wrote a paper. I think Wagner had one. I can't remember them all. And we met in this room at Fuller Seminary, and it was like a bull ring. They had this round table, and then the 10 of us sat around the table, and then they had these like tiered chairs with all these people sitting around sort of watching us down there. It was like, you felt like you were in a dogfight, and with everybody cheering you on, you know. But it was a very interesting, it lasted, I think, 3 or 4 days. And John Stott chaired the meetings. And out of that came a report called, a report published by the Lausanne Committee on the Homogeneous Unit Principle. I think it is still a very valuable report. And the report tries to express the same kinds of things we've talked about here. The report was very fair in explaining what was meant by the homogeneous unit idea, and then it raised the objections that we had. And even then, now 12, 13 years ago, it was one of my major objections. I remember pressing, I hope gently, Dr. McGavern on this, and I said, how is this biblical to start by talking about the particularity of the church? Or is it biblical to start by talking about the Catholicity of the church? Isn't the Catholicity of the church, the unity of the church, the strongest biblical theme? So that when we acknowledge particularity, we want to do it only within the orbit of the fact that Christ has made us one. And right, Dr. McGavern, as usual, said, yes, you're absolutely right. McGavern was a most unusual person. I cherish the correspondence he and I have had over 10, 12 years. Very gracious, always very open. In the mid-70s, we had a consultation here at Westminster of Reformed missiologists, and we picked the topic church growth. And we invited Glasser to come, and there were about 40 of us here. And that book was then, that was the papers in that consultation were published as a book. And I remember getting a note from Dr. McGavern thanking me for the book. And he said, we're going to use this as a textbook for our course on principles of church growth. And he was that kind of person. He was always willing to listen, even from critics, and appreciative when people could criticize it from a biblical point of view and be gracious in doing it. But these are not new issues.
I heard him speak maybe a couple of years ago, one of his last times, I think he spoke publicly, and the guy up in front of this group of people, and he said, my eyesight is not very good anymore, so I can't read my notes. So I've prepared this on tape in my own office where I have good lighting. Yeah. And he produced a tape recorder, and he turned it on, and he played the tape, and he did all the hand gestures to go with the tape. It was really cute. He's this little tiny guy with goatee,
yes, right,
white hair.
He lectured here at Westminster about 3-4 years ago, in January term, and we had invited him to come. And he made the arrangements. He was having eye trouble too. So what he did was he sent his lecture notes to Roger Greenway, and he sat in front of the class. I'm grateful it was a packed class. And then Roger Greenway stood up and read his lecture notes. And then afterwards, Dr. McGavern stood up and answered questions. And the lectures lasted for about 40 minutes, a 40-minute lecture, and then he answered questions for almost a full hour. But it was a very, very exciting time. And eventually his lectures here he published in book form under the title Effective Evangelism. But that was, I think, the second to the last book that he ever wrote. And we were honored to have him do it for Westminster Seminary. But remarkable person. I encourage you, just if you have not read McGavern and you're thinking of church planting or a ministry, you just simply cannot do that without coming to grips with some of the insights of McGavern or Wagner. These should be very high on your reading list. You may disagree with them, that's all right. But you'll find yourself having to formulate your own points of view in terms of what they say.